I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Love them or hate them, the New England Patriots have captured the country's attention like no other franchise. And today, we talk with Glenn Stout and Richard Johnson, authors of The Pats, an illustrated history of the New England Patriots. They join us from our WGBH studio in Boston. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Do I have Glenn?
Yes, you do.
Okay. Is Richard still stuck in traffic?
He's still stuck in traffic somewhere. It's
all
Boston.
Right. That's okay. Yeah, that happens. So you have included, I guess you said, the good, the bad, and the ugly in this book. So how did this idea come about and the collaboration?
Well, a couple of reasons. For one thing, you know, the Patriots have been around almost 60 years, and we looked around, and no one had really stepped back and done a narrative history of the team. And yes, the book is illustrated with a couple of hundred wonderful photographs and illustrations that Richard collected, but it's also 150,000 words, you know. The Patriots, I think, due to their recent success, are deserving of a full portrait of stepping back and seeing why they're so important to the region. And that's particularly true, I think, in regard to Patriots fans of recent vintage who only know the team as a dynasty, mm-hmm. as a team that seems to be in the Super Bowl every year, when in fact, you know, they were a laughingstock for most of their first 30 years, where they only made the playoffs five times and only finished above 500 11 times. You know, it's quite a journey and quite a trip from laughingstock to dynasty, and that's something we try to cover in the book.
Yeah. Now, before we get to present day, let's take a little bit of a look back. Early on, as you say, they were one of the worst teams in the franchise. Billy Sullivan, the first owner of the Patriots, tell us a little bit about him and his desire not only to build a team but to build a stadium.
That's right. Billy Sullivan came out of Lowell, and early on in his career, he said his biggest fear was to become a non-entity. And he served as PR man for the Boston Braves and a similar position at Boston College. And then the opportunity came up because he wanted to build a stadium. He thought that could make him a real estate developer. That would make him a big shot and a big deal. That's how he got involved in the AFL. They initially didn't want him in the club. Billy didn't have enough money, but they only had seven teams. Another team backed out, and Billy somehow cobbled together $25,000 from a group of investors and put down the deposit to place the Patriots in Boston. But the problem was he didn't have a place to play. They initially played at Braves Field, Nickerson Field at BU, Fenway Park, Harvard, BC, and Billy tried as best as he could over the first decade or so to try to get the state of Massachusetts and the city to build him a stadium. You know, Billy had the gift of gab, but he couldn't fool everyone, and no one wanted to finance Billy's stadium dreams.
Yeah, and he established the Jimmy Fund. I didn't know that.
Yes, he established a Jimmy Fund when he was working for the Boston Braves. That's, you know, he's got two real big legacies in New England sports. One is the Jimmy Fund, and the other is the Patriots.
Yeah. Billy owned it for quite some time. I mean, he had the team for a long time. And I don't think I really remembered that they started out as the Boston Patriots before they became the New England Patriots.
Right. They were the Boston Patriots initially. And then when Billy finally got so frustrated with the stadium issue that they built Sullivan Stadium, or initially Schaefer Stadium, this utilitarian structure in Foxborough, the decision was made to change the name of the team. His idea was to change the name to the Bay State Patriots because they were no longer in Boston. Well, it took headline writers about 30 seconds to figure out that they would call the team the BS Patriots, and they didn't mean Billy Sullivan. The NFL actually stepped in and told Billy, they're not going to be the Bay State Patriots. How about the New England Patriots? And that's how the team became the team of the region.
I'm going to jump up to the 1970s for a second here. So, and one of the highlights of the 1970s might be English place kicker John Smith, who was discovered at soccer camp. There's all these little gems in the book.
Oh, there's all sorts of gems like that. At one time, the Patriots radio station held a competition called Superfoot, where they went to England and tried to find the Patriots a kicker. They did find one. He didn't last very long, but the Patriots eventually came up with John Smith, who kicked one of the most famous field goals in Patriot history, although that's better remembered for a certain prisoner on a work release program who, during the Dolphins game, it was a terrible weather conditions. It was snowing all game long, and Mark Henderson, this guy who was on a work release program from prison running a small snow brush to keep the lines of the field clear, was waved onto the field and brushed the snow away from where John Smith could plant his foot so he could kick a game-winning field goal.
In 1970s, we had a superstar quarterback back then, Steve Gorgon.
Right. Steve Grogan came out of Kansas, and he replaced another superstar quarterback, a guy named Jim Plunkett, who was the number one draft pick, who unfortunately came to the Patriots, and he had no offensive line. He probably took more punishment in 3 years than Tom Brady has in 19. And when Plunkett finally broke down, Steve Grogan stepped in, and he was a running quarterback at a time that there were very, very few running quarterbacks. But New England fans always seem to respond to that kind of lunch bucket kind of player, the Larry Bird type, who's always, you know, diving onto the floor. Well, Steve Grogan was one of those kinds of football players and is still much beloved in the area. He runs a sporting goods store and has remained quite involved.
Yeah. Gino Cappelletti, of course, is a familiar name to a lot of folks, even those who maybe weren't paying that much attention to the Patriots early on, you know, the younger generation, if you will. Tell us a little bit about Gino.
Well, if there's anybody that deserves to be known as Mr. Patriot, it's probably Gino Cappelletti. And in my view, he should be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. But, you know, Gino was tending bar and playing semi-pro football for his brother when the American Football League started. He got a tryout with the Patriots, made the team, in part because he said, you know, I can also kick. He made the team as a defensive back. And after the first season, although he intercepted 4 passes, a lot of other passes went over his head for touchdowns. And they said, you know, you need to find another position as well as kicker. So he became a wide receiver. And through the 1960s, he was the most prolific point scorer in the AFL, both kicking and receiving. He is still the all-time, and will always be, the all-time leading scorer in the American Football League. But many Patriot fans remember him for his work as an ambassador for the team. He was a longtime broadcaster paired with Gil Santos, mm-hmm. and Gil and Gino together were the voice of the Patriots for generations.
Now, what a team that was, huh?
Absolutely.
I know, for sure. All right, let's talk a little bit about Leslie Vester, who was the first woman to cover professional football. She's done a whole, Quincy native, she's done a whole lot since, right?
Oh, absolutely. Well, one of the things we do in books like these is we always ask some of our favorite writers to weigh in with essays of their own. You don't want to hear my voice in the text for all of it. You want to get some different perspectives. And an obvious choice was Leslie Visser, who was the first woman to really cover the Patriots and a real pioneer in sports journalism. And of course, you know, when Leslie had to cover the Patriots, the whole question of women in the locker room, you would have thought the world was coming to an end. But and she deserves a lot of credit for, you know, soldiering through that time period and really paving the way for an awful lot of other women sports journalists to make it in this field. And Leslie weighs in with a pretty funny essay about her early experiences with the Patriots. Suffice to say, she was not welcomed with open arms.
Not a surprise when you think about it. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have a comment or question for us this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Donna from Sandwich has a question. She says, what does the Patriot way mean? Do the Patriots truly operate differently than other teams in the NFL?
Well, you know, the Patriot way has kind of been adopted as a catchphrase to explain their recent success. To a degree, the Patriots have done things a little bit differently. I mean, they were one of the first teams to kind of realize how to work the salary cap in the league. You know, the Patriots, with the exception really of Tom Brady, over the last 20 years or so in the Belichick, Kraft, Brady era, they have tried not to have superstars because superstars tie up a lot of money. They like to have good players, but they don't want to have to pay them like superstars. So part of the Patriot way is getting rid of a player like the old baseball general manager Branch Rickey. Better to get rid of them 1 year too soon than 1 year too late. So the Patriots have never had these. Often what you'll see with other teams is they'll reach a level of success or a championship. I mean, look at the Eagles last year. Mm-hmm. They win the Super Bowl, and this year they've collapsed. Often that's because they have to pay tomorrow for what you did yesterday. The Patriots have kind of avoided that. And if there's a Patriot way, it's kind of that philosophy to, you know, and it's also very mercenary and very cutthroat. There's not a whole lot of sentimentality in the Patriots front office. It's what did you do? What can you do for me today? Not what you did for me yesterday.
Mm. 1980s got off to a bad start for the Patriots with a series of embarrassments, right? 1980, they lost 8 games by a touchdown or less.
Yeah, I mean, the Patriots really hit a swale for a few years. They'd been pretty good at the end of the 1970s, and then Chuck Fairbanks, their coach, on the precipice of what looked like could be Super Bowl championship season, he decided he wanted to coach the University of Colorado. So instead of game planning for the Patriots, he was calling high school football players in Colorado and trying to convince them to join him, in Colorado in college football. And so the Patriots were, a bit out of sorts. And one of the reasons they kind of came back then is they promoted an assistant coach that no one thought was head coach material, Raymond Berry, who was a very quiet man who sometimes babysat the children of the players on the team. They elevated him to the coaching position, but he, at the time period, was just the kind of calm, quiet presence that the team needed.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, too. This is true of other sports as well. But, when we were growing up, I think, Glenn, we're about the same age. A lot of players, they played with the same team for their entire career.
Right.
Yeah. And that, boy, what a difference now. Like, I hate to see Wes Welker not with the Patriots.
I know. Well, it's never more true in this era that you don't know the players without the scorecard. Because, it is that shuffled, players are shuffled in and out. And, contracts aren't in the NFL, aren't guaranteed. So it's very easy for players to be released and be moved around, in between seasons. So you really never know what you've got, particularly with the Patriots, until you get three or four games into the season and they kind of realize what they are and what they need to be.
Yeah. And just get used to them and say, wait, no, don't go. Right?
Exactly. Get your autographs now.
Yeah. Doug in Falmouth says the Patriots have a tight-lipped culture, especially when talking with the media. What was it like to write a book about them?
Well, we didn't really ask for much for the Patriots, so that didn't bother us at all. This is what I refer to as kind of a survey history. It's built off the primary resource material, which is really the newspapers and the magazines that have covered the team over the years, as well as supplemented by the fact that I can look at some YouTube videos and relive plays and everything. But, the Patriots, particularly in this era, they're much more remote from the fans than they were in the Billy Sullivan era in their first years, where, we have photographs in the book of, a kid sitting on his bike at the very edge of the practice field. Mm. If you tried to do that now, you'd probably be arrested and taken away. And, the Patriots now are almost the equivalent of a multinational corporation. They're very focused on one thing. And, you have lost a little bit of that connection between the players and the fans that in the early days, was just much more intimate.
Yeah. So what was it like doing the research for this? Because, this book is really chock full of a lot of stuff. And as you say, there have been lots of books written about the Patriots, but not really this kind of complete history.
Yeah, not really the full narrative. And that was the real fun of it is, is the ability to kind of step back. And along the way, I always try to keep three questions in mind, because Richard and I together have done, team histories of the Red Sox and the Yankees and some other baseball teams before. But the question that I try to keep in mind is, why and how did they win when they won? Why and how did they lose when they lost? And why do people care so much about that? And as long as I stick to those questions and try to find the narrative arcs of the various eras of Patriot history, and then the larger arc from laughingstock to dynasty, I think that allows you to gain a perspective on the team. And, it's funny, if you're under 30 years old, you don't know anything mm-hmm. about the Patriots other than the fact that all they've done is win.
Right.
And, I think one thing this book will do is not only great for older fans to kind of relive their entire history with the team, but for younger fans to just realize how special and how unique and perhaps how fleeting this era is. It's not like this all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, younger Red Sox fans have the same feeling, too. All they know is World Series championships. If you go back a generation, all we knew was chance of 1918.
Right. We're talking with Glenn Stout, who, along with Richard Johnson, is the author of The Pats, an illustrated history of the New England Patriots. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.com. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Glenn Stout, who, along with Richard Johnson, is the author of The Pats, an illustrated history of the New England Patriots. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's talk about Victor Kiam for a minute. Remember, Mr. Remington there. I liked it so much I bought the company. Remember his commercials, right? All right, so talk about, I guess he liked the the Patriots enough that he bought the team?
Well, many people buy professional sports franchises because it can make them famous. And Victor Kiam liked being famous. He liked being the spokesperson for Norelco. Unfortunately, his tenure with the Patriots was somewhat checkered, because during that time period is when Boston Herald reporter Lisa Olson was sexually harassed in the Patriots locker room, which was a terrible scandal, one that Victor Kiam mishandled, and one that eventually, you know, forced the Patriots to be sold. In the long run, that worked out for Patriot fans, and fortunately, Lisa Olson was also able to overcome that, and she's continued to have a very distinguished career as a sports journalist. Mm.
I love how you started this chapter, the chapter 1986 to 1992, where you call it Close Shaves. Pick your metaphor: train wreck, car crash, nightmare, cataclysm, act of God, whatever phrase you choose, it was wicked awful. For every member of the Patriots organization, their fans, and even those who covered the team, the next few years were a careening disaster, both on the field and off, a scorched earth of incompetence and ineptitude, a catastrophe unlike any other to befall an NFL franchise. And I mean, you don't sugarcoat it.
No, we don't sugarcoat it, as my colleague Richard Johnson and I, you know, decided early on. It's like, we want to, we respect Patriot fans, and they'll take the bitter with the sweet. They know what this team was. They know the bad things that have happened. There's no reason to shy away from anything. We tell the story straight. You know, no one wants a Hallmark card or a Valentine. Mm-hmm. You know, they want their history for real, because they have a real connection to a real team. It's not just this fake thing that, oh, we're just going to be a fair weather fan when they're good and abandon them when they're bad. You know, as Richard can speak better to this than I can, he's now joining us, that the Patriot fans, you know, have a real, real strong connection to the team, and the older fans had to fight for that connection.
Mm. Well, what heightens it even more is the fact that the nature of football itself is it's once a week. So you have the, you know, action on the field, and then you have the week in between to muse on all of the other stuff. And for many of those years of ineptitude, it was all the other stuff that was the topic of discussion, not the play on the field.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk to Larry, who's giving us a call from Yarmouth. Good morning, Larry.
Morning. I am old enough to remember the Boston Yanks. I once saw a game of them against the Redskins. It might have been at Braves Field or at BU Stadium. A long time ago, and I wondered if that's covered in the book, and what is the relationship between the old Boston Yanks and the Patriots?
Well, we actually cover, I wrote an essay at the start of the book about the heritage of pro football in Boston prior to the Patriots, and there were 5 pro football teams, including the Yanks. Of course, I wonder who the marketing genius was who came up with the name Yanks for a team playing in Boston. But there were the Bulldogs, the Braves, who became the Redskins, the Shamrocks, a team called the Bears, who played at Fenway Park for 1 year in 1940, and then the Yanks, all prior to the arrival of the Patriots. And it's interesting, the Yanks' relationship to the Patriots is not direct, but they eventually, that franchise moved to New York, were called the New York Football Yankees, then became by various degrees of, you know, contractual moves and things, became the Baltimore Colts. So now if we have a schedule where we play the Redskins and the Colts, we're playing two teams that started in Boston. So, you know, the pro football history here was very checkered prior to the arrival of the Patriots, and was actually quite checkered until, you know, the past 25 years or so. So it's an interesting story. And, of course, the game itself, football as we know it, was born in New England. Most of the rules and the names of the positions, your quarterback, halfback, and everything, were created by Walter Camp down at Yale. So this area was no stranger to football, but pro football was always a curious fit here. But, you know, they finally figured it out after all those years.
Mm. Well, Larry, thanks for the question. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, let's jump up to Bill Parcells. Becomes the first coach, and at that point was the 33-year history of the team, the first professional football coach. Took a while.
In a lot of ways, it was. I think you can break the history of this franchise into two halves, and one is before Parcells and one is after Parcells. And the big difference was is that with Bill Parcells, for the first time, you had someone who had been a successful NFL coach before joining the team. Previous to that, they'd selected college coaches, they'd selected assistant coaches from the professional ranks, but Bill was the first guy who had really experienced success. And the other big factor with Bill Parcells is not only did he expect to win a championship, I mean, that's what he stated when he came here, that's what I'm here to do, but Bill also became the face of the franchise. And for so many years, the face of the franchise, kind of by default, had ended up being Billy Sullivan. Mm-hmm. And Billy was charming to a degree, but he'd kind of worn out his welcome. People had kind of become disenchanted with him, always saying things were great when they often weren't. And Bill Parcells came in and, you know, a big ego, a guy who told it like it was, and the press and the fans loved hearing that. They loved somebody who had high expectations. They loved someone who, you know, if they lost and they were lousy, Bill would say they lost and they were lousy. Mm. And that really changed just about everything here in Boston.
Yeah. 1994, Robert Kraft buys the team, and trouble for Bill Parcells, shall we say.
Yeah, something about groceries and cooking the meal.
I love that line. It says, it's just like a friend of mine told me, if they want you to cook the dinner, at least they ought to let you shop for the groceries.
It's a great line. Of course, what we have to remember is at the time the Kraft family bought the team, there was really a question as to whether they could even stay here. You know, that the rumors were because James Bush Orthwine owned the team at the time, there were rumors that they had a foot out the door to move to St. Louis. In fact, they had already chosen a name, St. Louis Stallions. Mm. And so they were headed west. And when the Krafts announced the sale, Bob Kraft recalled in a statement to the press that when he was a young boy in Brookline, one of the heartbreaks of his youth was when his team, his baseball team, the Boston Braves, had departed for Milwaukee in spring training of 1953, and he did not want to see the football team that he had supported as a fan. You know, they had season tickets on the 40-yard line. He and the boys would go out every Sunday through thick and thin and support the team the way the fans did. And, of course, the response of the fans to his purchase was immediate and enormous. Season ticket sales soared. They basically sold out, you know, as though it was an announcement of a reuniting of, you know, the Beatles or something. It was just this, you know, that folks were driving to Foxborough to stand in line. And it's been that way ever since. So, you know, we can probably thank the Boston Braves. And, of course, who was the PR director of the Boston Braves for years? Billy Sullivan. Mm-hmm. So this, as a community, is a small town, but as a sports town, it is a village. It is a tiny community, and everyone's connected to each other by one degree or another. But the Krafts not only saved the team, kept them in New England, but they've, you know, brought forth a dynasty. It is a remarkable stewardship.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Pete Carroll. Pete, and this is probably about the time I moved back to this area and started, you know, becoming more of a Patriots fan than wherever else I lived. Pete Carroll was a different kind of coach.
Sure. They kind of counter-programmed. You know, after you had the rough, tough taskmaster of Bill Parcells, you know, figuratively beating his players into a pulp with his tongue, then they brought in the cheerleader, the friendly guy, the guy who wanted to be your best friend, you know, Pete Carroll, who was all sorts of enthusiasm. And, you know, he was jacked and pumped all the time. I think that's one of our chapter mm-hmm. names. And he put a shine on everything. He really wanted people to like him. The problem was, and Pete Carroll was not a bad coach because, you know, he's gone on to success in college and then at Seattle. He wasn't a bad coach, but he couldn't measure up to Parcells. He just didn't seem like as strong a personality. And then every year he was here, they got just a little worse and just a little worse and just a little worse. And Boston media in particular, after having Parcells, who told it like it was, they didn't want Pete Carroll to put a shine on everything when it wasn't all shiny. And I kind of feel bad about his, you know, Bob Kraft actually felt very bad when he had to let him go because he liked him.
Yeah.
And he thought he was a good coach, but it just wasn't the right fit here.
You know, I felt bad for him, too. But you could sort of see, you know, when they're going in the locker room at halftime, somehow I didn't think they were very fearful of Pete Carroll.
Well, they went from Jack Nicholson and a few good men to Mr. Rogers. and in a football context where there's, you know, a lot of posturing, a lot of, you know, a lot of testosterone, Pete Carroll's hang loose attitude, while the players loved it, just didn't, you know, it was almost but not quite. And again, replacing a garrulous legend is a tough thing to do.
It's hard shoes to step into. All right, before we talk about Tom Brady, let's talk about Drew Bledsoe.
Drew Bledsoe, it was one of the great, most talented quarterbacks, certainly I've ever seen. And again, Glenn can profess objectivity in this story. I'm a Patriots fan, and I have been for 55 years. So he helped lay the foundation, really, for the dynasty. And, you know, we will always be grateful to him for coming in against the Steelers in the AFC Championship game in 2002 and getting them to that Super Bowl, that first Super Bowl. That was key. And, you know, it capped a tenure in Boston that was really quite successful. About the only blip on the radar screen was when he did the crowd surfing at a concert where one of the concert goers got hurt. I'm trying to think of the band that they were seeing, but it was
the Mosh Pit at the Paradise.
The Mosh Pit, right? The Mosh Pit at the Paradise. But no, he was a matinee idol, sort of mold of quarterback, handsome guy, tall, very accomplished. He and Parcells laid the foundation for what was to come.
Well, and I think you also have to give him a whole lot of credit because after Mo Lewis virtually tore him in half, you know, and knocked him out of the starting spot, even though Bledsoe wasn't happy about being replaced by Tom Brady, he didn't stand in the way.
Right.
He didn't go public demanding to be put back in the starting lineup. He wasn't happy. He went to Bob Kraft. He went to everybody and let them know that he wasn't happy. But he didn't stand in the way, and he helped when he could.
Yeah.
And that's being a professional. You know, being a professional is doing what you're supposed to do when no one's watching. Everybody was watching then, and Drew Bledsoe took the right attitude.
Yeah, I was sad myself, excuse me, when Drew Bledsoe was, you know, replaced by Tom Brady. But interestingly, I can remember how many times you'd be going, Drew, throw the ball, right? But Tom Brady also has that kind of pause as he's looking, you know, and you guys make a really interesting point. There are some who believe that Tom Brady is still able to play at such a high level because of his lifestyle and that TB12 diet. You argue that it may be more due to the design of the offense and the rule changes that have been made during his career.
Yeah, I think there's really two things that have helped him. One is, and we can go back to when he first stepped in for Drew Bledsoe, they kept things very simple for Tom Brady those first couple of years he was quarterbacking the Patriots. They didn't ask him to do things he couldn't do. He's got a strong arm, but not the strongest arm. He doesn't need to throw the ball 60 yards, but he's very accurate. He's not fast on his feet, but he can get rid of the ball quickly. And they've built an offense built around the strengths, what he can do. And as his mental skills have increased over time, because I think he's probably seen more snaps at quarterback and looked at more defenses than any quarterback in history at this point. As his mental faculties have increased, they've just built on that aspect of his game. So he can read defenses faster than anyone. As his teammate Ted Johnson said, he beats you with his brain and not his arm. And he's smart enough to know that he doesn't need to take punishment. get rid of the ball in 2 or 3 seconds. They use a lot of crossing routes, a lot of shorter passes. That has saved him from taking the kind of punishment that, like, a Jim Plunkett did. And then, of course, the other thing is that over the nearly 20 years that he's been behind center, the rules have changed, sometimes in subtle ways, sometimes in less subtle ways, to keep the quarterback ever safer. So the quarterback doesn't take the type of punishment that they did in the past. And if you look around now, there are actually a number of quarterbacks, most namely Drew Brees, who has also been at the highest level for a lot longer than players in the past. So, you know, I think Tom's lifestyle is very useful and has kept him as healthy as possible, but he's really been helped out by those other two factors as well.
I thought it was interesting, too, Pro Football Weekly's draft expert, Joel Buschbaum, his sort of analysis of Tom.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, Joel Buschbaum was kind of one of these guys that was no team employed him because he didn't want to work for anybody, but he was basically an amateur. He pored over videotapes and watched games from all over the country. And, you know, he came out and basically said that if, you know, in the right offense, that Tom Brady could be one of the best quarterbacks ever. And not many people thought that. Brady, you know, split the position at Michigan. But one other guy who thought that was the Patriots quarterback coach, a guy named Dick Rabine. And when Dick Rabine first scouted Tom Brady, he thought he had something special. It was like he'd found the Hope Diamond. But he was the only one. I mean, Tom Brady was the 199th player drafted the year that he was picked in the NFL draft.
Amazing. We're talking with Glenn Stout and Richard Johnson, authors of The Pats, an illustrated history of the New England Patriots. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Glenn Stout and Richard Johnson, authors of The Pats, an illustrated history of the New England Patriots. 866-999-4626 is our number if you have a comment or question for us. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, the team is taken on troubled players. Some have worked out, some have not. I think Christopher Gasper at The Globe had a great article in September, and he says, the Patriots want to be the good guys while taking on the bad guys. And of course, Aaron Hernandez comes to mind. And you write, as a variety of media reports would later reveal, the Patriots really didn't want to hear any bad news about their tight end prodigy. And when they did, they tended to look the other way.
Well, that's not just a Patriots problem. That's also an NFL problem.
Right.
The league as a whole has a very checkered history of dealing with players who, you know, have committed domestic violence or who have had other issues, particularly issues of violent sexual assault. And it's nothing that any of them can be proud of. The pressure, they look at it with almost one eye closed with blinders on. The pressure on them is to win. Often they're so one-sided focused just on winning that I think they're blinded to larger issues. And, you know, those issues have to be continually brought up because they are really important. And, you know, at one point when Myra Kraft was still living, she kind of, you know, held her husband's feet to the fire on the issue. And when, you know, someone would commit an act like that, she would bring it up and let him know that that was not okay. She's not there anymore. It's up to the media and up to people like ourselves to continue to raise the issue and to make sure that the Patriots and the NFL as a whole and professional sports as a whole is responsive to this issue because it's so, so important.
Yeah. Matter of fact, I have a question from a listener. It says, has the team of franchise culture changed since Bob Kraft's wife, Myra, died?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I think we probably know more about how teams operate now. So, you know, one would say you maybe small y, yes, but, you know, who really knows what, you know, what has happened about players that we don't know? I mean, I tend to, as a fan, I mean, I don't put the blinders on, but, you know, if we knew everything, we probably would be doing something else on Sunday afternoons.
Yeah. I'm going to bring up CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, if I can spit it out. And going back to Aaron Hernandez, researchers say he had the most severe case they had ever seen in someone of his age, 27 years old. And you touch on it on the book. You don't get into it a lot, but you touch on it. And it's a big issue right now, and I guess we're learning new things about it all the time.
It absolutely is. And, you know, that's one of the opportunities with this book is that when you tell the stories of the Patriots, you also get to tell the story of professional football during this era. And you'd be remiss if the concussion issue wasn't brought up. You know, in doing the research for the book, the number of Patriot players, Nick Buonaconi, Jim Plunkett, Tim Fox, guys that are affected either by CTE, well, which can't really be diagnosed until after death, but have issues with dementia, have issues with memory, things like that. You know, it's endemic in the game, and as we're learning, it's affecting almost everyone. And there's a time of reckoning that's going to come with that. And that's something even as a writer and journalist who writes about football occasionally, it's something that I have to struggle with because, let's face it, you know, a lot of people, Bob Kraft, Bill Belichick, Tom Brady, and a lot of other players have, you know, become rich and wealthy off a sport that leaves many of its players diminished. And that's something the NFL in some way is going to have to come to terms with. You know, people aren't going into it blindly now. At least there's awareness now that that is an issue. But, you know, but it's a disturbing one. And, you know, as the Aaron Hernandez, you know, incidents underscore, it's one that ripples through. It affects more than the players. Mm-hmm. It affects everyone around them.
Yeah. And, of course, is likely to continue to make changes in the rules of the game. I know with the younger kids now, the rules are changing. Obviously, you don't want these young kids having concussions.
Right. And, I suffered a couple of concussions when I was a young kid playing football and found out 6 or 7 years ago that some mild medical conditions I have today might have their roots in those concussions I suffered when I was 11 and 12 years old. Mm. And that was a sobering thing for me to learn and really underscored the dangers that some of these players are undergoing every Sunday.
All right, let's get your take on Deflategate.
I'll pass that one to Richard.
Well, okay. In my own estimation, much ado about nothing. I mean, what I don't understand is what did the cost and legal fees end up being for that entire charade? What, $20 million or some crazy amount? What I don't understand is why doesn't the league control the footballs used in a game? It'd be a great sponsor opportunity, too, that this football break is brought to you by, you know, so-and-so, where as in Major League Baseball, where the balls themselves are in the umpire's room, sealed in their boxes before the games, and, you know, the umpires bring the baseballs out. I mean, you know, so we learn that Green Bay quarterback Aaron Rodgers likes his footballs, you know, super inflated, you know, the opposite of the deflate thing. All right. Okay, well, in the game against the Colts in question, Brady could have been throwing a cantaloupe and he'd have beaten them. I mean, it is just one of the weirdest cases I can think of in sports. And it's one, of course, that had the tabloids going crazy and, you know, the media just a frenzy about. And I still don't quite understand why another quarterback can have the footballs inflated so that they're, you know, almost like throwing a piece of wood. And then our quarterback, the balls are, you know, slightly a little softer, and that somehow it's this big scandal. I just don't
get
it. Well,
it would have helped if they just would have said, yeah, we did it, so what? Let's move on. Mm. It was the cover-up, not the crime, that I think got everybody in trouble.
Yeah. And so what is it that, you know, I mean, there are so many people across the country outside of our New England area who really hate the Patriots and hate Tom Brady. Is it a jealousy thing, do you think?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's the price of winning. I'm reminded of Derek Jeter, how he always used to say that, you know, he always loved it when he came in Boston and got booed, because if they're really hating me, you know, that must mean we must be doing something right. So now it's the Patriots' term to kind of, take that mantle on, you know, because here's the thing. If you're loved or hated, at least you know people care and you've got their attention. And that's the price of winning, yeah, is that almost as many people are going to hate you as are going to love you. And, you know, at this point, it's serving the Patriots in both ways, because they're also laughing all the way to the bank because their merchandise is one of the top sellers in the NFL. They haven't had, you know, every game, exhibition, playoff, regular season since 1994 has been a sellout. And I don't think they mind if people watch them hoping they'll lose as long as they get to win at the end.
Yeah, it reminded me of a funny story. I'm sure you both remember Carl Bean, who was the voice of Fenway. And Carl tells a great story how when he would announce Derek Jeter, he would go, "Derek, pause, 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 Jeter," so that he'd get booed twice, which I just think was very funny. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the future. And we've heard these rumors of tensions between Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, and Bob Kraft. What are your thoughts on that whole situation?
Well, I always look at them as like a three-legged stool. They've been together for about almost 20 years, all three of them. And I don't think either one individually knows how successful he would have been without the other two. And I think at a certain point, each of them starts to wonder about that a little bit. And as they each get towards the end of their careers, I don't think it's over, but I think you can kind of see the end of that relationship. I think that kind of brings in a little bit of natural tension. But I also think that, you know, it's such a unique situation that Patriot fans, you know, appreciate what you have while you have it. This is a very, very unique thing and something that we may not ever see again.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I would say appreciate not just every game, every snap that Tom Brady takes. It is unprecedented. They are in uncharted waters. So, you know, the future, well, okay. We can live on the fumes of the past once things do go, because, you know, they will certainly. But when? Well, you know, in any other situation, the dynasty would have already been over. Mm-hmm. No, it's not. In fact, the fact that in last February's Super Bowl, it went to the very last play. And, of course, we were all hoping that Gronk would somehow get his hands on that ball in the end zone. I mean, that in and of itself was remarkable. And now they seem to be headed towards a division, another division championship, another playoff appearance. I mean, I've been a fan for many years, and just having one playoff appearance was great. But these Super Bowls, this run of success, it is just truly remarkable.
And besides, that always leaves room for us to add another chapter later and reissue the book.
Let's talk a little bit about something that we didn't mention, is that's the great illustrations and photos in the book. Pat the Patriot gracing the cover of the first ever regular season home game. Pat the Patriot didn't last too long, though, did he?
Well, Pat the Patriot, I think, is still the enduring image for a longtime fan. So, yes, he is not the helmet emblem now, but you go to the pro shop, and he's still there. He's very, very prominent, and it's a wonderful image for the team because, you know, it was drawn by a cartoonist, mm-hmm, Phil Bissell, still going strong at age 93, and it was a cartoon that first appeared in the Globe in 1959 when they announced the start of the franchise, and then was adopted as the helmet emblem a year and a half later. And the deal was Phil got to draw the program covers for the first 10 years on a handshake. And he told me that Billy Sullivan once said to him, you know, in reply to a question of, "Do you want to see the covers before I hand them in to the printing company?" And he said, "No." He said, "I know people are going to love your covers, and I look forward to the surprise of going to a game and grabbing one from a vendor and seeing what you've done." It is really a charming relationship. And the images themselves tell a story. I mean, it basically is the story of an underdog league and a team that didn't take itself too seriously. I mean, and the AFL, in stark contrast to the NFL no fun league, you know, the AFL really did do more to make themselves fan-friendly, and part of the evidence of that are these wonderful covers. And, of course, they were also the league that, when John F. Kennedy was killed, canceled their games. The NFL did not. So I like to think that when the merger occurred, the NFL merged with the AFL, not as much the other way around.
Well, and you have this whole section of Phil Vassell's work, and I think my favorite is the Patriots versus the Jets, which shows the Pat the Patriot eating a box of Jets cereal.
Yeah, well,
there's some great ones in here, and the, you know, riding the Bronco.
Oh yeah, Phil's a wonderful gentleman. He's a great cartoonist, and the only other cartoonist I can think of that had the same impact on the identity of teams was the great Willard Mullen. Drew the Brooklyn Bum, you know, for the Dodgers, and drew the, you know, the hulking giant for the baseball Giants. But those images were never really used as the logo of a team. So Phil really stands as the singular cartoonist who had the greatest impact on the identity of a pro sports franchise. And I love the fact that his creation, he calls him his third son, Pat, is still going strong and will give him a measure of immortality.
Doug would like to know, when Bob Kraft bought the Pats in 1994, they weren't exactly a winning team. What did he do to turn them around, and what makes him a great team owner these days?
Well, one was that he had the foresight to put himself in play as the sole owner of the team. You know, he had owned the Boston Lobsters in World Team Tennis earlier, and the team only existed for a few years, and he realized when he owned that team that one of the reasons they didn't succeed is he didn't own the facility, he didn't own the parking, he didn't run the concessions. He just ran the team. Everybody else made money off everything else. And so one of the smart things that Kraft did is by the time he bought the Patriots, he decided that if he was going to buy this team, he was going to control the stadium, he was going to control the parking, he was going to control as much as he possibly could, that it was all going to be on him. So there wouldn't be any question of who was running things or anything like that. You know, under Billy Sullivan, the Patriots had a board of directors. They had, at one point, 11 different people who had to weigh in, who had to make decisions. By consolidating all that with one person could say yes, one person could say no. Although Bill Parcells tried to be that one person too for a while. But by having just one person at the top, it just clarified things and simplified things. And I think the Patriots, as much as anything else, have just benefited from that stability. You know, and he did get a stadium built. Mm-hmm. And that's something Billy Sullivan couldn't do. You know, Bob Kraft wisely bought Sullivan Stadium because he knew that the lease ran through the year 2000. And when the team came up for sale, everybody would have to go through him. And if he was able to acquire the team, he knew that he had the land, that if there was ever a new stadium built, it would probably have to be right where the old one was. And he was right on all counts.
What about the money? And this is not true just of football. This is true of sport. You know, you mentioned like the kid sitting on the, you know, practice field watching the game. And now, you know, take your family to any, you know, baseball, football, the money that's involved in all of this is just seems so astronomical. What are your thoughts on that?
I try not to think about it,
except
as a research topic. But as a fan in any sport, I try to ignore all that. And I think a lot of fans do. I mean, some get caught up in, you know, playing salary cap games or, you know, how can we get a free agent for this and that and the other. But if you just focus on the game on the field when it's being played, and I turn down the sports talk chatter and all that stuff, and I just try to watch the game on the field as much as possible as a fan. Now, as a journalist, sometimes you have to pay attention to other things. But
well, and the money certainly in football, most of it's non-guaranteed. And unlike most other pro sports, these athletes are going out there in a game where one play can alter their lives, can ruin their lives, you know, where afterwards they're sitting in a dark room somewhere dealing with brain trauma. So I hope they make all the money they can, to be quite honest. I watch the games from the comfort of an easy chair with HDTV. I'll occasionally will go to a game, but you know, the money is certainly, as long as it's distributed to the players, I'm all for it. I'm a union guy all the way. And, you know, they do run that great risk on every single play.
I also like to remind people that, you know, for $30 at a book like this, $30, $35, you get 900 games. You know, the cheapest ticket at Foxborough, I think, is about $140, and you only get a single game. So, you know, you can spend your money the way you want. Right?
Do the math.
Yeah, do the math.
Glenn Stout and Richard Johnson are authors of The Pats, an illustrated history of the New England Patriots. They'll be at the Falmouth Historical Society tomorrow, December 6th at 2 p.m. And then at 6:30 over to Tickham's Bookstore in East Sandwich. We'll have a link with more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks, guys, for being with us and doing the book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to Doug Shugart and Miles Smith for production assistance in Boston. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.